This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, the business station. My name is Rich Bradbury. Welcome to Cruise Control, the car show here on BFM. I'm going to welcome my friends to the show. First up, Daniel Fernandez from DSF.my.
Hello. Good evening. And thank you for having me back on the show, guys.
And of course, the man with the news, Mr. Arif Aruz.
Hello, everybody.
How are you both doing this week?
Fantabulous.
All right, I guess, yeah.
One's fantabulous and one's all right, I guess.
Yeah, you know.
We've got interstate travel. We've got stuff about the Peredur Ativa, Geely. We've got a car review, a used car review coming up. Some sneaky Porsche news and some other stuff. Why don't you take it away, Mr. Arif Aruz, man with the news.
All right, so as we all know, as what was announced yesterday, or was it day before yesterday? Nobody really knows.
I've lost track.
Yeah, interstate travel will now be allowed between RMCO areas. So it might be a bit confusing, but I will explain. CMCO areas, you still cannot enter RMCO areas. But if you are in an RMCO area, you can go through the CMCO area to get to another RMCO area. Confusing enough?
Huh?
So basically, if you wanted to go on holiday and you're from Putrajaya, which is an RMCO area, you can go to Melaka, which is an RMCO area, only in a tour bus via KL or Selangor, which is a CMCO area. So, thoughts?
Okay. Do you have to get tested before you get on this group travel bus?
Not as far as I know.
When they go from the RMCO area via the CMCO area to the other RMCO area, can they stop at the R&R in the CMCO area on their way to the RMCO area?
No.
Do you see how confusing this could be for some people?
Right. I'm also confused because I'm wondering, if I want to take my helicopter and fly to Melaka, is it okay?
Yes.
I mean, that's... Yes.
Then I've got no issue. I'm okay. I'm good to go.
As long as you're going via the CMCO area in your registered tour helicopter.
Okay, cool.
I think.
Understood.
Your helicopter has to be registered with the tourism ministry.
Okay, I can get it.
Which, of course, it is, right?
It is.
Okay, well, that's incredibly confusing. But yes, interstate travel is allowed somewhat. Yeah. Do your own research.
I think the best thing is, you know, if you really want to go anywhere, just go to the nearest police station and ask their advice. Because that's what I did. I went to the nearest police station a couple of weeks ago. The person at the main gate was so helpful. I said, listen, I want to go to this place. Am I allowed? He said, no, you only can go A, B, C, D, E, and you can't go to D, E, F. Thank you very much. I walked away. I didn't have to queue up. I didn't have to worry. And I got it from the right person.
Brilliant. That's all you need to do then.
Visit your local police station and they will tell you what to do.
Okay.
Anyway, some real car news. Mm. The new Peredur Ativa. That was the biggest talk of this week, previous week.
It happened last Wednesday night, right after our show. So we couldn't talk about it on the show, but today we can talk about it.
Yeah. So Ativa, it means active in Portuguese. Yes. So I guess this Peredur Ativa is supposed to represent the millennial Malaysian who loves to be active.
Or maybe it was designed by someone from, the Portuguese settlement in Melaka.
That's an interesting take on things, yes.
Looks like it belongs in Melaka too.
Yes.
Anyway, prices, very, very friendly. 61,500 for the base model all the way to the top, which is 72,000 ringgit. Since last week, deliveries have already begun. Peredur are saying that this car is 95% local, and they say it's the highest local content of any Peredur model, even the engine and transmission, which is good news for the local auto industry.
Mm.
And particularly something that we talked about maybe a month ago, right, when they were going on this tangent of saying, we are a new car company that cares for the Malaysian automotive industry.
Yes.
Having said that, this Peredur Ativa is actually designed by both Peredur and Daihatsu. So it allows for common components to be built easily, i.e., you know, the infotainment, steering wheel, buttons, all this stuff. But they're saying that the amount of contribution that this car will have on the industry is about 6.5 billion ringgit worth of components from Malaysian suppliers.
Great news, yeah.
As predicted, Daniel, you said that this car was smaller than the X50, and it kind of is.
It is. It's basically, what I said was, it's like the previous Myvi, the long-standing 10-year-old Myvi.
Yeah.
It's the same cabin size, it's sitting up higher, and it's got a more angular exterior, whereas the old Myvi was a very curvaceous exterior.
Mm.
But it's what is underneath this shell that it's so amazing. And I use the word amazing because at this price point, Peredur has ticked all the right boxes to make this a bestseller for at least 5 years.
Yeah, agreed. This is the car that they are ushering their new identity in. So they even underline the fact that this is a tech-packed SUV crossover thingy. So the car will come in three trim levels. One is the X, which is the lowest model, 61,500 ringgit. Then the H, which is 66,000 ringgit. Then the Avant, 71,000 ringgit. As Daniel mentioned, everything that's under it or in it is very important. So powering the Ativa throughout the range is the 1-liter turbocharged three-cylinder, which is essentially an Axia engine with a turbo slapped on it. Mm-hmm. 98 horsepower, 140 newton meters of torque, and a first time for Produa, which is a CVT gearbox with 7 virtual speeds. We don't get the four-wheel drive version. That's strictly only a Daihatsu and a Toyota car, but everything is two-wheel drive, front-wheel drive.
Mm.
And in terms of safety, it's quite impressive too. You've got parking sensors, reverse camera standard, and then if you step up to the top two models, you get the ASA Advanced Safety Assistance 3.0, 6 airbags, lane departure, everything, even adaptive cruise control, which is awesome at a car this price.
Wow.
It is. But the thing is I want to warn, you don't want to use the word warn, I want to caution people to don't take this adaptive cruise control as something that you use in the city, because you still have those little motorbikes whizzing in and out of traffic, you know?
Mm.
And who knows what the sensors might do.
Yes.
Just use it on the highway, I'd
say, right?
Exactly,
exactly.
Anyway, among the other things that's fancy with this car is actually they've got LED lights front and rear, automatic high beam, so that if you turn on your high beam when you're going down Kara or whatever and a car's coming the other way, it will avert the eyes of the headlights to not blind the other person. So that's nice.
All by itself?
All by itself.
That's a bit fancy, isn't it?
Very fancy.
The feature that, correct me if I'm wrong, Daniel, was introduced in BMW's Mercedes not too long ago.
You're right, exactly.
Another interesting feature about this car is that every car has those memory, well, not every car, but some cars have those memory functions in your seat. Well, Produa has decided to introduce air conditioning memory functions. So if it's really hot outside, you just press M2.
Genius.
Super genius, right?
Genius.
How has nobody thought of that?
This is going to be one of those things that, you know, will save arguments when you get in the car. It'll be like, have you been touching my aircon? No, I've not touched your aircon. Are you sure you've not touched? I've not touched. Click.
Having said that, it's a pretty impressive car, right? You still got the 9-inch touchscreen infotainment with Android Smart Link, no Android Auto or CarPlay. But there has been some comparisons, especially in the way that this is not Produa's first small SUV. The first small one was the lovable, loyal Kambara. And I guess a lot of people are wondering, does it offer the same feeling?
I don't think so, because the Kambara was narrow and tall.
Mm.
And the Kambara was very basic, and the Kambara was very reliable if you took care of it. This, I think, has got a lot of tech in it, so you have to be a little bit careful in the long run. Of course, during the warranty period, Produa After Sales will take care of you. So it's not like a Kambara. Number two, it's more planted on the ground. It's not sitting very high up. So it'll drive like a small little hatchback. So you see, the word SUV and crossover doesn't work with me. I will just look at it as a small city hatchback.
I'm looking at it as the, I don't want to say it, but the Myvi killer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Why would you buy a Myvi when you have this?
Why would you have a Myvi over this?
Right. Oh, dear. Did we say, we said it out loud, didn't we, as well?
Yeah.
I mean, don't get me wrong. The Myvi is a great car, you know, and the new models are great. People are buying them in spades and whatever. But this thing, at this price, with all those features, it's a no-brainer.
Exactly. Right.
But think about it, guys. You see, the Myvi has been around for a couple of years now. It's selling well.
Mm.
There might be a facelift Myvi coming with all these exact features inside.
And I would welcome that.
And a lower price.
Yeah.
Because it's easier to do it. So, you know, you could be looking at a $50,000 Myvi that has all these features, which caters for a different demographic of buyer.
Speaking of small SUVs, apparently Volvo has plans for a city hatchback, according to Daniel, called an XC20. If you thought the XC40 or the C40 that we spoke about last week was still too big of a car for you, this is a subcompact SUV that I guess will be similar in size to the Produa Ativa.
No, it's actually going to be same size as the Proton X50.
But the Proton X50 is the same size as the XC40, isn't
it? No, the XC40 is bigger. If you take the XC40 and put it right next to the Proton X50, the XC40 is wider, taller, and also a little bit longer.
Yeah.
If you see it separately, you might think it's about the same size. But if you put it side by side, the size difference is there. But this XC20 from Volvo, to me, I think is basically a reshelled X50, which is a Geely... Binyu.
Well, the reason why we're talking about the XC20 is that this new subcompact SUV, they're calling it, is going to be built on their sustainable experience architecture called the C. And it is apparent a few interesting things about this architecture. It's the world's first open source EV architecture, which Geely says is for the betterment of the entire industry. It has an EV electric vehicle chassis that can hold anything from a car designed like the Axia to an Accord-sized car. Even has a variant developed for light commercial vehicles, and it has already debuted in the brand new Lincoln Co. I guess the big question that you wanted to bring out, Daniel, was, is this potential for Proton to be, you know, an easily executed EV?
Well, it should be if Proton wants to go down the EV road, because Perdua has hinted after the launch of the Ativa that they might go down the EV road, but we don't know when. You know, saying that could be 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years from now. I don't think it's going to happen so soon because their partner, Daihatsu and Toyota, don't have a strong EV product running in Japan right now.
Yeah.
Proton, on the other hand, should take advantage of this and play the EV game. But we don't know the politics. We don't know what Proton has in plan for the future. We don't even know what Geely has planned for Proton in the future.
Hang on. So am I reading this right in that the C platform is essentially a base thing that you can build on top of, right?
Yes.
Almost like a Meccano set,
correct,
if everybody knows. Well, this is, it's pretty game-changing, right?
It should be. I mean, it's obvious. It would be just something like literally just putting a body shell on it and sticking a Proton
right.
badge.
Okay, but then we don't allow kit cars here in Malaysia, right? Would this be, come under that kind of...
No. This will not be called a kit car because it's still coming from a proper manufacturer. It's still going to be built in a factory. It's not like they're going to sell you a platform and you build it yourself. It doesn't work like that.
Okay, just wanted clarification on that because if that was the case, I'd be building my own on this.
Well, first you have to get your license.
Yeah. Yes.
Working on it.
There was an interesting interview by a competitor who shall not be named, but that interview, the Proton chief designer, Aslan Othman, revealed a few things, one of which was they will eventually redesign Geely-based Protons, and they will promise to have revolutionary designs in the next 5 to 6 years. But looking into electrification, he said, we have to, we can't get left behind, but to say it is a major focus, probably not at the moment, which is, I guess, kind of disappointing.
Mm. But not surprising.
Yeah, not surprising, yeah. Especially in the current state of, you know, us, Malaysia.
Mm.
But had a conversation with a few friends about this. And, you know, we had a little debate on which national car, because we have three now, don't forget.
Right.
Do we think it's going to take the first steps into electrification?
I don't think so.
No?
I don't think so. Honestly, I don't think the national car brands are looking at electrification seriously, simply because if they were, they will make a statement, they'll be very strong about it because they're already in partner, they're both in partner with people who have hybrid or electrification or some form of alternative energy source. If they're not making that statement, that means there's no serious intention because why? You're making too much money selling petrol-based cars. Why bother going to something which you have to revamp your workshops, your service centers, your after sales, your warranty, your training program and everything else? Let's keep it simple, gentlemen. That's what they will say. Let's keep it simple. Let's make as much money as possible because we still got a lot of Malaysians who will believe in us.
Something you agree with, Rich?
I'm on the fence about this. I mean, obviously, you know my opinion on this. I really want electric vehicles in this country. I'd like to see more hybrid vehicles in this country. But it's going to go back to that same argument and discussion that it's about the bring it in sense, so to speak, in the fact that we've still got a lot of oil, we've still got a lot of petrol, which drives our market. We don't have the infrastructure yet for electric vehicles as of yet. And if that was something on the immediate horizon, we'd be talking about it, and we're not.
Yeah.
You know,
very fair.
Yep. It's something that every time somebody asks for a statement about it or a discussion about it, it kind of gets, yeah, we are, but not really. You know, that's what it feels like.
Yes, exactly.
Totally agreed.
Yeah.
I guess we'll leave it at that.
We'll leave it at that. Let's take a short break, shall we? And when we come back, we're going to be talking all about the new Porsche. A short little break here, ladies and gentlemen, on Cruise Control here on BFM 89.9 with me, Rich Bradbury, Arif Ruse, and of course, Daniel Fernandez from DSF.my. We'll be right back in just a few moments here on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Because freedom matters. BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, the business station. My name is Rich Bradbury. I'm on the phone lines with Arif Ruse, the man with the news.
Hello.
And over there is Daniel Fernandez from DSF.my. Say hello, Daniel.
Selamat petang, tuan tuan dan puan puan.
Just before the break, we're having a bit of a discussion about the confusion of interstate travel. Yes, you can. CMCOs, RMCOs, just go back and have a listen to it. It's confusing. Then we've got the Peridua Ativa, Geely's new EV platform. We've had a bit of a discussion about whether or not the national car is likely to take any steps into electrification. Probably the short answer is no. But now, what are we talking about? Something a little bit fancy.
Yes, it's a posh car called the Porsche. And they've released a new variant for the Porsche Taycan, which we have hardly seen in Malaysia, even though it's already been on sale.
Yes.
This new Taycan is not called the Sport Turismo, but it is a wagon, and it's called the Cross Turismo. Porsche are calling it a mild off-roader. So it's basically what Volvo does with their cross-country cars.
Correct.
You know, slightly raised, they add some off-road plastic cladding on the car, and it's essentially a wagon. So roof bars and all that stuff. Extra 20 millimeters in height, so...
Is 20 millimeters, does it really make a difference?
It does if you're going to your kampong, you know, the red earth road, you know, off the main road, you know, that little bit of, you can go past the lalang easily, you know.
Just thinking, you know, many of the potholes here in Malaysia are a little bit deeper than 20 millimeters.
You know? This is what the car should have come stock with.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess this is kind of like targeted towards, you know, the wealthy farmer or somebody who has a lifestyle and needs to carry bicycles every weekend of some sort. Yeah. Essentially, though, this is Taycan, but with a boot. All electric, under 3 seconds, 0 to 100 time, hundreds of horsepowers. Mm. But some other interesting news from Porsche this week was that they have started to increase their investment into Rimac, spending about $70 million.
Yes, and why Rimac? And why so much money? Now, there's so little information about Rimac on the net. You realize that, right?
Yeah, because you know, that Grand Tour presenter crashed one of 8 Rimacs in existence.
And, you know,
oh dear, oh dear.
He sold so few cars and the cars are very exclusive. But Rimac is a technology company before you call them a car company. They've been doing a lot of development on battery technology, on, you know, electric charging and battery charging and all these kind of things. So by Porsche buying to Rimac, they've realized that Rimac has the technology to make the electric car ownership even better, battery charging even faster. So if I buy into this company, I can take the technology. And what's also interesting, a couple of years ago, Hyundai also bought shares in Rimac. And Rimac has been sharing a lot of their technology and supplying a lot of components for Hyundai and Kia electric vehicles.
Mm, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. So this guy is very smart. Matt Rimac is the owner of Rimac. He's very cool. He's in Croatia. So looks like Porsche, like I said before, Porsche Taycan is not really 100% a Porsche. So many components coming from so many people around Europe, and this is one of them.
A little bit of background on Rimac. It's Croatian. They built bespoke supercars. And the interesting thing, like Daniel said, you know, they are a technology company first and foremost. So everything they design, develop, and manufacture are done in-house. And it includes even the buttons, infotainment, headlights, wing mirror buttons, which normally car manufacturers would just pick out from a parts bin from Fiat. But this EV supercar, one of the cars that they're most famous for, called the C2, makes up to 2,000 horsepower and costs over $2 million per car. And like Daniel said, all this expertise in building this car is what Porsche is buying into. And it's kind of a perfect match for a niche brand like that, you know?
True.
And no controlling stake. Porsche is just kind of sitting in the background. Here's some money.
Mm.
You do what you do.
It feels like Rimac is the kind of Apple of the car world. And yes. They're getting money from Bill Gates almost. That's what it feels like.
You're right in saying that. And also, you see, when you say Rimac is like the Apple of the car world, I would say Rimac is the Koenigsegg of the supercar world.
Ah, yeah.
That's well put, yeah.
Mm-mm. Right, from Rimac to another R word, the RAVs.
What a big difference in value.
Well, I didn't want to say one is more valuable to you know, to it, but... RAV4s, right, yeah, can have wonderful value for people who are looking for them, and in particular the 1996 model. That was not the best segue I've ever done in my radio career, but I'm going to go with it.
Yeah, whatever, man. Daniel, take it away.
Okay, so this week we're looking at a used SUV, the Toyota RAV4, a 1996 model. Now, the RAV4 has been around for a long time, but it's never sold in big numbers, as you guys know. You do see it on the road, but you don't see them all over the place like you see the Nissan X-Trail or the Honda CR-V. And the reason is very simple. Toyota has never had local assembly for the RAV4, RAV4.
That's interesting.
And they've never had it in the region. So they didn't even have local assembly in Indonesia or Thailand or anywhere else in the region. It was always coming directly from Japan. So the price was expensive. I'll give you an example. When they first launched the RAV4 in Malaysia, it was fully imported. And at that time, the Honda CR-V was already selling very well. The price difference was almost 30,000 ringgit.
Yeah.
You know, and at that time, 30,000 ringgit, you can already buy a Perdua, a brand new Perdua. So I think they brought in like 100 units and they sold 100 units and that was it. Nothing else. But as the years progress, this 1996 model, which is the first generation RAV4, started getting popular with the used car importers, the grey car importers. They started bringing in from Japan 3-4-year-old units. And of course, you know, when cars are older and they're reconditioned, the tax is very low, especially those days, you know, they could do a lot of fudging with the numbers. So then a whole bunch of these RAV4s came into the country and they were sold as used second-hand models. Now, a lot of them ended up in Sabah and Sarawak and Labuan. And the reason was simple, because at that time, roads in Sabah and Sarawak were quite bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were almost as bad as Petaling Jaya roads. And and people in Sabah and Sarawak needed to get around. Oil and gas was moving actively. The loggers were moving actively. But of course, the ones with money will go and buy a Toyota Land Cruiser or, you know, the what they call them, Ninja Turtles, the big Prados.
Yeah.
You know, yep. The brick LX47s and all that. But not everybody could afford them. And the problem is, at that time in Malaysia, pickup trucks were actually pickup trucks. You didn't have lifestyle pickup trucks. You had really heritage trucks that had a...
The one with a wooden bench in the front.
Yeah, you know, they're reasonably... Okay, I'll give you an example. Maybe you remember this, the Ford Courier.
Oh, yes.
2.5, no turbocharged. The radio had push buttons in it, you know. Very, very hardy suspension system, but they were workhorses. And the Toyota Hilux at that time was a real workhorse. Today, if you see one of those old Toyota Hiluxes, they're worth a lot of money because they got classic appeal. The Land Cruisers at that time, they were called the BJ10, BJ20. Those are really hardy vehicles. Today, they're collector's items. So at that time, a luxury truck would have been a Land Rover Defender.
Really?
Yeah.
That would have, well, I guess just because of the brand.
And it was, you know, slightly more comfortable than these other vehicles. So, of course, if you needed something with four-wheel drive, high ground clearance, a little bit more than 20 mm, which the Porsche Cross Turismo provides, you would go and buy a used Toyota RAV4.
Just want to point something out when I was doing research about this car is that this apparently was the first ever compact crossover SUV.
Yes, you're right.
And another interesting thing, the REV initially stood for Recreational Activity Vehicle.
Yes.
But it soon changed to Robust Accurate Vehicle, four-wheel drive.
What?
Because it was robust.
And it was accurate, apparently.
It was accurate in its destination.
I spent an awful lot of my formative years being charioted around in one of these.
Oh, really? The UK. In UK?
Yeah.
And it never failed, right?
Never failed. Never failed. The green machine, we used to call it.
Your parents had one?
No. Let's just say it was a close friend of mine.
Ah, okay. Was it a female?
I'm not saying. Yes.
So did you ever venture into the back seat to find out how comfortable it was?
That I can neither confirm nor deny. However, there was an awful lot of off-roading in it. Because she lived out in the middle of nowhere and, you know, amongst the sheep and cows and literally off-road. And it was purchased specifically from going from out in the middle of nowhere into the city. So it was ideal for that.
So it was an actual farmer's vehicle that worked
anywhere. Yeah, it was actually bought for that purpose and not for like looking like you drive off-road. It was for actual off-road work, yeah.
So this is why it worked so well in Borneo, because at that time, of course, the Honda CR-V and Nissan X-Trail were selling, but this was more reliable and dependable because this was actually an off-road vehicle. But small, compact, cute, you know?
Yeah.
So we go back to the vehicle. Plenty were sold in Sabah and Sarawak. Over the years, many of those units from Sabah and Sarawak have ended up in Semenanjung, Malaysia. So that's why you see some of them having Sabah and Sarawak plate numbers for sale in our used car market. Still, there are still plenty of local models in the country, and every now and then you see one or two being put up for sale. So why did we pick this vehicle? Because some people had come to us in the past and asked us, you know, what's a good cheap runabout second-hand vehicle, but we want a bit of off-roading. Not that we want to go off-road, but, you know, we live in Selangor, so we need something that's a little bit tough. We need something that's cheap to maintain. You know, all these little boxes need to be ticked. And over the time, we've advised people to buy the CR-V. We've advised people to buy the Nissan X-Trail. Even asked people to go and look at the Suzuki Jimny. But the Suzuki Jimny is two doors. You have the long wheelbase and short wheelbase. But a lot of people say two doors is a little bit tough to get in. And also, the Jimny prices have started going up because it's become a collector's item.
Mm. Didn't the RAV4 have a two-door version as well, though?
Yes, yes. And the two-door version is now starting to go up in value.
Interesting.
Guess what, guys? Only in America, they produced a soft-top three-door cabriolet.
You're right. You're right.
Which looks very interesting.
It was basically to compete with what came out from Daihatsu. Daihatsu had a vehicle called the Feroza. And the Feroza had a T-top, a Targa top, with a removable plastic rear. So it wasn't a convertible. It was basically a hard rear back, which you can remove and keep at home and drive around. But if it started raining, you had to rush home.
Yes.
Yep. So Toyota said, okay, you can do that. I will actually give you a proper soft top which you can open and close.
Yeah.
You know? So the two-door, of course, you can find them in Malaysia. But then again, because the prices are going up, I don't really advise it because it's really small. It's really shrunk. You know what I mean?
Mm.
Yeah.
And once you have someone sitting in the back, if at all like Richard, you'll actually be hitting the rear hatch glass.
It was, I guess it was kind of like a Toyota MR2 on stilts.
You're right. So back to this four-door RAV4, 1996 model. Today in the market, you're going for between 10, 11,000 to about 15, 16,000. Now, why there's a big difference in price, of course, some of them will advertise for 20,000. If you go on the classifieds online, you'll see some people advertising for 20,000. I think people think they can get a little bit higher price because the two-door version is asking for 20,000. But what they don't understand is the two-door version has become a bit of a collector's item. Now, the four-door version, if you get it around 11, 12,000, it might be on the lower end. It might be, you know, reasonable, but check the history. Because remember, if this car came from Borneo, it's been through a hard life. Now, if this car was registered in Selangor, it's been through an even harder life because of the potholes and manholes, you know, and the speed bumps.
And the floods.
And the floods. But remember this, like any off-road vehicle, you have to take it to a workshop, jack it up, look at the underneath. Underneath, you can see what kind of damage has been done to the chassis and all the little components. So you know whether this car has gone into the rough or it's just been a tarmac bruiser.
Mm.
And then when you get into the car, get into the back, pull the carpet out a little bit just to see if there's mud and sand inside so you know it's not been flooded. Same thing with the door panels. Pull the door panels from bottom because that's where a lot of mud and sand will be sitting if it's gone into the flood.
Yep.
Okay. I'm not saying all these cars go into the flood. They're high enough to avoid a flood. But if it's been in certain areas of Malaysia where people have taken it into some severe off-roading, like some pickup truck owners, you will have all these kind of issues. And you don't want to buy something like this unless you intend to take it off-road and trash it, you know?
Mm.
So, engine-wise, 2-liter engine, straightforward, no headache at all. Parts are easy to get. Any good, reasonable mechanic can fix it. When you get inside, plastic trim, it's hard. It feels very, very cheap, but it's very hardy. It's very hard to find a Toyota RAV4 with broken plastic interior.
Mm-hmm.
And the good thing about this vehicle is even if it was 1996, you still get two airbags.
That is actually pretty cool.
Yes.
I guess it reminds us that this was, you know, mid-90s, early 90s. This was the time where Japanese cars were the best cars in the world.
Exactly. Because it came from Japan, it was fully imported. It had two airbags. And then you have that 4-speed automatic gearbox. There are some manual versions out there. Very, very, very rare. I've only seen one in my whole lifetime. But the automatic, that 4-speed automatic, please don't dismiss it because it's 4-speed. The 4-speed is bulletproof. It's got no issue. As long as you got the gear oil changed regularly, it should be no issue. Now, if you buy one that is having gearbox issues, you can buy a second-hand one. There's no issue. You know, and then that's where you can bargain the price. But this car is hardy. This car is built to be abused, like what Richard did with his girlfriend back in England in the countryside.
Easy.
with his friend.
Thank you.
With his friend's car.
Oh, with his friend's car.
Yes.
You know, and you must understand, generally, Toyota RAV4, if you think about it, it's sharing a lot of components. I'm talking about the simple components with the early Toyota Camry.
Yeah.
So a lot of things, a lot of consumables you can actually share with the Camry so you can make it work. Of course, things like suspension and drive and, you know, steering, no, not, but, you know, there are a lot of other little things under the dashboard that are shared. Because why? Toyota was famous for making it as common as possible to make it as easy and reliable as possible. So if you look back now at this vehicle, look at the pictures. If you go to DSF, you can see the pictures. It's not really looking that old and ugly, right?
Yeah.
It still looks rather fresh. It's compact. It's interesting. It's got some curves on it. If you give it a nice coat of paint, maybe, you know, a new set of alloy wheels. I mean, for me, you know, maybe you lower the suspension a bit because the roads in Selangor have been improved. It can look quite modern and nice.
It's like how they say fashion comes back. Fashion is a revolving door or something like that. This still works today because it technically looks like, you know, one of those 90s bomber jackets or 90s raincoats, colorful and everywhere. It just represents the time.
Yes.
And the time where this car was really hip and still remains hip.
Correct. Correct.
I don't know. I think even in the UK back then, it still had a little bit of a stigma attached to it.
Stigma meaning? Because it was Japanese?
No. Not because it was Japanese. I think back then, more people were like into their kind of Ford Escorts and their, you know, and this thing came along, and I don't think people in the UK really knew how to look at it and how to take it. It seemed to be a vehicle for people that had a little bit more money than others.
Mm-hmm. I can see what you're saying, Richard, also because I, if I remember correctly, at that time, SUVs were not a big thing in England.
Correct.
You either go Range Rover or you go car.
Exactly, yeah. And so this kind of sat in an odd place. Yeah. And it's like, oh, what is that? You know, it's neither that. What exactly is it? And then you took a little ride in it, and it was fun. It felt like it bounced around a little bit. It felt like if the wind came along, it might not quite tip over. But yeah, you'd be a little bit concerned about that. But, you know, you got used to it, and it's a steady beast.
Are we therefore saying that it was kind of ahead of the curve?
Yes.
I guess in some ways, yeah, for sure.
In terms of the shape, because at that time, everyone was going angular, square, sharp edge. And this here comes along this, you know, this curvaceous SUV, you know?
Yes.
And then, you know, a little bit of wide arches. Of course, with the Toyota badge, people started looking because Toyota was at that time famous for its sports cars, the Celica, the Levin, the Supra.
Yeah.
No one looked at a Toyota SUV, you know?
All right.
And if you really wanted something hardy, you go and buy a Land Cruiser or a LX, you know?
Yep. Toyota actually made an electric version of this car back in 1997.
Yes.
And it was in production for 6 years. 1,484 cars were leased or sold only in California. The car had a 193-kilometer range, which is fantastic by today's standards even.
Yeah.
130-kilometer-an-hour top speed, fair enough. 60,000-mile battery warranty.
But how long did it take to charge?
I just looked at the old brochure and it said that you needed like one of those special wall boxes that powered something like 6,000 watts. It's crazy. But as of 2012, apparently there were only 500 left on the road. And Toyota says that some cars have been driven more than 240,000 kilometers. That's pretty cool.
That's pretty amazing.
Okay, so now the question comes is why didn't Toyota continue on this electric vehicle program?
Well, the battery was more of a consumable item rather than something you replaced like in 10, 15 years.
Right.
And to replace that, it costs more than buying a new car.
Because battery costs were way too high. That is why Toyota, after that, in the quest to look for fuel efficiency and everything, started going down hybrid, smaller batteries.
Very interesting stuff.
So that's why, you know, Toyota has never shied away from electric vehicles. They've tried it. They looked at it. Cost too high. Let's go back to something more reasonable. And then there's no issue about charging, range, anxiety, and all these other issues. So now everyone says, no, I want electric vehicles. Toyota and all the other Japanese manufacturers are still holding back, not because they don't want to do it. You see, the rest of the world is saying we must have electric cars. But if you look at it, the Japanese are saying, okay, you go ahead, lah. You do first, you know. You want all your problems. And then, for all you know, they probably have electric cars already made, ready, superbly efficient, quick charging and everything else. But they said, okay, we're not going to produce this yet. Let these other guys go out there, shout, wave the flag and everything else. When the time is right, we will just flood the market.
Ah, see what we've got, huh?
Something like what Porsche did. Why did it take so long to come out with the Taycan? You know, when everybody else in Europe was jumping up and down and Tesla was flying the flag so high. But the moment they launched the Taycan, they were bang, straight up the charts.
Yeah.
The Tesla Model S had 8 years to prepare for the Taycan and it still couldn't beat it.
Yes.
And on that note, let's wrap up, shall we?
Yes, we should.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have been tuned in to Cruise Control, the car show here on BFM 89.9. We've been speaking about interstate travel, the Perodua Ativa, Geely's new EV platform, and then, of course, the used car review, the 1994 Toyota RAV4. If you missed any part of this show, don't forget you can download the podcast wherever you normally download it from. We recommend the BFM app. It's available in the Apple App Store or Google Play. If you can't do that, head over to bfm.my. You can have a listen there. And of course, we are streaming on Spotify. Oh, and we have an Instagram account, don't we?
Yes, we do. It's at BFM Cruise Control.
We'll be back same time, same place next week for your favorite car show in the world.
At 8 p.m. on Wednesdays.
Yes, ever. Worldwide, if you're streaming. This has been Cruise Control here on BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.